Committee, and unfortunately, at the end here, everyone is everywhere else. We will begin our hearings. We can't take action, of course, but we can listen to the presentation. We may have one other senator join us, but at this point, it's just me, Gary Stevens. And we'll begin with Mrs. Moss. We're even glad to have you with us, and we're going to talk about House Bill 133. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Reneva Moss, legislative aide to Representative Coghill. House Bill 133 started out as a single subject piece of legislation that addressed aggregate votes. There is a regulation on the books that would provide for annexation by aggregate vote. That means that you would take an area to be annexed, you would take their votes and combine those with the votes of the existing area, and if the majority of the people voted yes, then that area would be annexed. Representative Coghill feels that is contrary to intent, contrary to statute, because existing statute says that the people in the area to be annexed must approve of the annexation by a majority vote. So we started out with a piece of legislation that basically said, and I'll give you the section in the new bill, it would be Section 4, which says that regulations providing standards and procedures are subject to state law. And that's consistent with the Constitution that says a law and the legislature is interchangeable. So a law is discussed in the Constitution as a law that is passed by the legislature into statute. Additionally, Representative Harris had a couple of concerns that we have addressed in Section 1 and Section 2. We've gone through kind of a change in cycle committee by committee. Originally, this legislation would have required a vote in order for the Local Boundary Commission to bring a proposal to the legislature. We have since got advice from our legal, and they have said that they felt that probably would be challengeable and we would lose the argument, that it appears to be unconstitutional. So we have changed it to require two public hearings if they decide to come to the legislature with a proposal. Also in Section 1, we had language that said that the Local Boundary Commission could not change a petition and could not add additional requirements on the petition. Legal felt we might be able to win the fight, but we didn't want to destroy the original intent of the bill. So we have changed that, and we just require the Local Boundary Commission to make a public notice of the changes that they are requiring and give time for public comment. The last thing this bill adds to the statute is a requirement that the people in the area, the existing municipality, would have to vote by a majority vote to approve an annexation. And the reason for this is we could see where a large area could force themselves into an existing borough through the annexation because they would be the only ones that would vote on the annexation. This requires, the way this bill is now, it requires two separate votes, just like service areas. I don't know if you're familiar with them. But one vote would be the area to be annexed, one vote would be the area that is the existing municipality, and both of them separately would have to approve the annexation for it to happen. And I'd be glad to take questions.
Well, thank you, Reneva. And I'm sorry, Senator Kukesh is here. So as I follow that through, then both the area annexing and the area being annexed have to have a majority vote. I'm trying to think how it applies in practical terms. Let me give you an example. We're talking about the Donlin Creek mine and a potential borough out there. The mine is in an area that's not populated, but maybe there is a small community nearby of just a few people. So what we're really saying is that we would be giving veto power to what could potentially be 20 people?
Yes, Mr. Chair. They, under existing law, they have that veto power.
They have that right now.
Correct.
So how does this change? How does this bill change that?
This bill changes because it also requires the vote of the existing municipality. to say that they do want to annex this area in.
Okay, so the existing borough. Okay. Thank you. Any questions, Senator Cash? Great, we have a few people that want to speak to us. Thank you, Reneva. I appreciate you being here. Steve Thompson in Fairbanks. Mayor Thompson, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Comments you may have on this bill?
Chairman Stevens, I appreciate the opportunity to address you people on this. I've got 3 points I need to make on this. One of them is kind of like the historical side of annexations and where we are today. I note if you go back in the history of Fairbanks, some of our earliest lawsuits were over annexations. I think the same holds true in Anchorage. One of the ones that I recall most is the Spinard area. When they wanted to annex that, there was quite a battle. Here in Fairbanks, the annexations of Slaterville and Grail and Hamilton Acres were hotly contested issues, and now they're right in the middle of our community and part of our thriving town, the same as many of the ones in Anchorage. So history's proven out on local adjacent annexations that they work out to be the best for the communities. Our problem here in Fairbanks with this is that we ran out of property. We've got an area or other areas immediately adjacent to our community that might be a 500 to 1,000 acres that are the expansion area for growth for our community. We want to maybe annex that, put in roads, storm drains, prepare it for utilities, and get it to where it can be developed into an industrial area or a subdivision for housing. And maybe there's one person that lives out in that area, and they could vote no, and that's it. We're done. That's another big concern we have. And one of our major concerns is that I understand the concerns of rural areas or areas that are remote from a borough that they're trying to annex, that the services provided might not be as understood or greatly therefore possible. But when you're talking the immediate area around our community here in Fairbanks, we have a 34 square mile boundary. We've run out of property. We have 30,000 people live inside of our city limits, but in the immediate area there's 80,000, and all of the jobs are in our community inside the city limits. So you've got about 50,000 people a day traveling in and out of our community. They work inside the community. They expect to have police protection, fire protection, ambulance protection. They want the roads plowed and the potholes fixed. Then they drive back out of the city, and they provide none of the funding that it takes to provide these services. So this is something that I think needs to be looked at, is that majority of these people that drive into town and work in our community, the largest employers work in big buildings that are tax exempt. Our biggest employer is the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. We get no city taxes from it. We have the federal building. We have the big state courthouse, the borough building, the school district headquarters, the schools, all of these big employers. People drive in from the borough, utilize our services, drive back out, and we have no way of recovering any costs. So we're trying to make it to where that we can annex the immediate populated areas around our town that are part of our community. And this would stop us probably from doing so. I think that those items have to be taken into consideration when you're trying to figure out how to stop annexations into remote areas that they aren't going to be able to provide services. So we do have those concerns that you could rename this bill the Anti-Economic Development Bill if you wanted to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So it's your belief that this bill is something that would cause you more trouble than you already have?
Yes, we feel that it would. We feel that it would slow down our ability to develop areas for economic development. We feel that it would be burdensome for us to try to get to that point and to expand. I mean, growth is vital, and the opposite is not good. And we feel like this would encumber our growth.
Well, thank you, Mayor Thompson. I appreciate your comments. Any questions? All right. Thanks very much for being with us, sir.
Thank you.
Lisa Von Bargen from Valdez. Ms. Von Bargen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No comment at this time.
Okay, and we also have Mike Black, DCCED, and they're here for questions. Is that right, Mr. Black?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Do you have any comments you care to make, Mr. Black, or are you just here for questions?
We're here for questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience care to speak to this issue? Again, I apologize for the fact that we don't have, we have only two of us here. Hard for us to come to a majority vote with only two. Yes, Reneva? Yes, please.
Again, Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill.
Just a minute, Reneva. We've got something going wrong with the mics here.
Maybe if I back up, is that better?
No, I don't think so. Testing. Oh, I think that's okay now. Go ahead. Thanks, Reneva.
I did want to address Mayor Thompson's concerns. Under state statute now, the people living in the annexed area would have to vote on annexation. This is taking nothing away from what the process already is. What it is taking away is a concern that Representative Coghill has about a regulation that is inconsistent with state statute, a regulation that dilutes the voice of the people in the area to be annexed. And I must disagree that the people who live outside of the city are not contributing to the facilities inside the city. We have user fees, we have fuel tax, we have driver's licenses, we have, the state puts a lot of money into that city and facilities. And even though we don't have an income tax, Alaskans are not freeloaders. They are contributing to the state treasury, and I think that should be recognized. I don't see how this could slow down their process, because what we're doing is making sure we don't have regulations that are inconsistent with state statute, and that's what this bill does.
Thank you, Renee. So make sure I understand this. So presently, it's an aggregate vote, and you clump together the however many thousand people there are here and how many thousand people there are there. You add them together, and a majority rules.
Presently, it is a vote of the people of the annexed area. In Fairbanks, what brought this to our attention is Mayor Whitaker, he made the statement that there is a regulation on the books that would allow him to do an aggregate vote to annex basically everything south of the Yukon River. And this concerned Representative Coghill that that regulation existed. We looked it up. Sure enough, it was there, but it is inconsistent with state statute.
Thank you very much, Renee.
And as far as the local boundary commission is concerned, they have said that they have never used that aggregate vote. I haven't checked to see if that's true or not.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Again, we're just hearing testimony this time. We also have Senator Wagoner is here with us, and I know he has another meeting going on.
Yeah, they're going to put the bill up next, so
okay.
I'll be here for a few minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much, Senator Wagoner. Well, let's go on to the next item then, which is Senate Bill 179. Do we
have...
Yes. Yes, we're going to hold this over and have a chance to have the rest of the community hear a little bit about it and provide them with information, and we will hold that over until we have a full house here. So we have other people here for... Okay. All right. We'll move on to Senate Bill 179 relating to the taxation of mining property. We've had a chance to hear this once, and we have with us Steve Van Sant, state assessor. Mr. Van Sant, thank you for being here, and appreciate you coming forward to let us know what this bill does and answer any questions that may be out there.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Steve Van Sant. I'm the state assessor with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and I'm here at your beck and call. Whatever you want to know, I'll try to do.
Well, thank you, Mr. Van Sant. We're trying to figure out this bill and the impact it may have, and I guess one of the concerns we had was a severance tax and the issues surrounding a severance tax. This does prohibit a municipality from having a severance tax on minerals, on mining. And my guess question is, how would that happen? How would that be implemented?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the original bill actually exempted a lot of taxes in municipality. In fact, almost every tax I could think of exempted those that could be levied against a mining operation. And I assume we're talking about the CS now, or are we talking about the original bill?
Just the CS.
Oh, okay. The CS actually made a lot of changes that we had recommended, one of those being the severance tax issue. One of the issues that we saw with the severance tax was the fact that, I don't know how to say it politely, so I'll just say it, it appeared that a municipality could hold a mining operation hostage by threatening a severance tax. And so after looking at it and thinking about it for a while, it was our position that the resources actually belong to the people of the state of Alaska and should fall under the state rather than a local municipality. So it just made sense that a severance tax should be reserved to the state. And if the state wished to levy a severance tax, it could do so statewide or by category. And that seemed to take a lot of the negativeness out of this bill, at least to us. The changes that we saw in the CS, quite frankly, most of them look pretty good to us. It's acceptable anyway at this point in time. The main thing was not to have one entity carry the entire tax burden for a community or a proposed borough, but to have that shared by all the residents of that area. And that, you know, being an assessor, we always look at things pretty black and white. Everybody shares in the same thing. So unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. But this is one where we got the ability to come in on the ground floor and say, you know, if we're going to levy a tax, let's make sure it's not levied against one person or one operation. Let's make sure that everybody shares in the cost of the local government. So the CS went a long way in doing that. So that's kind of where we are on it, sir.
A question that has concerned me a little bit is a property tax. We were looking, this bill talks about a 4-mil property tax, and that you can't, a local, if there was a borough, they couldn't have a property tax only on, say, a mine. They'd have to be taxing their own property as well. And my question concerns ownership of property. Thinking of my own communities, many of the homes and villages are owned by agencies, I'm not sure, BIA or through other agencies. They funded that. How is property tax established? Is it based on ownership or on occupancy, or how does that work anyway?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, basically, when we're talking about property tax, we're talking about everything is taxable unless it's specifically exempted by law. Now, obviously, state property, federal property, city property, borough property would all be exempt from a property tax unless a private entity is using that for their own purposes. Good example, at all the airports in the state, on the Alaska Railroad, there are entities that lease property from the state. Those interests are taxable to the extent of what the law says, to the extent of that interest. So they pay what we call a possessory interest, based on the possessory interest in there. The ownership dictates taxability. The ownership as of January 1. So if a church, for example, had a piece of property that it owned January 1 and used for religious purposes and sold it January 5th, the exemption would carry through for the entire year. By the same token, if they purchased one January 5th, it would be taxable the entire year. So January 1 is a magic day in property tax. As far as the ownership goes, if the entity that owns a property is a tax-exempt entity, such as a federal government, the state government, or a borough, then that property is exempt, unless there's a private interest in it. If a mining operation or private individual leases or uses that property for their specific purposes, then they're taxable to the extent of the interest. Again, I'll raise the issue of the Red Dog Mine in the Northwest Arctic Borough. The mine itself is taxable. When I put the full value on several years ago, I included the road, the port, the storage facilities, about $130 million worth of property. That was all property that was not owned by the Red Dog Mine, but they had an interest in it, and subject to a possessor interest property tax. The legislature subsequently exempted that interest specifically for that one operation. But any other operation that came in would pay a tax on it should they have a local property tax. Or if they didn't have a local property tax, at least we would include it in our full value determination for educational funding. So the ownership dictates as of January 1. However, private interest accrued to that would also be something we would look at, too. So they would pay property tax on it.
The mine, would you say, you're talking about, right?
Yes, sir.
I guess the question I'm getting at is that AML spoke to us last Municipal League and said that there's a perfect balance in this. If there was a new borough, that if they property taxed the mines, they'd have to pay property tax on their homes. And since you know those areas something better than I do, is that true? Or would, in fact, many of the homes be exempt and would they just be raising tax from the mines in any event?
Well, the majority of the property in those areas is exempt. The vast land is owned by state or federal properties. The private homes, if they're restricted deed, native allotments, or ANCSTA property, they'll be exempt unless they're leased to third parties. Restricted deeds are exempt. The ANCSTA properties would be exempt unless they're developed. So, not knowing how much ANCSTA property or restricted deeds out there, the bottom line is we do that in Anchorage, we do it in Fairbanks, you do it in Kodiak. Those properties are exempt now anyway. Some areas will have a higher percentage of those deeds than others. But there, you know, one question that typically comes up are the HUD homes that are in some of these properties. And the bottom line there is we have an AG's opinion on that, is that while the underlying fee is exempt on that, the possessory interest that the purchaser has in that property is taxable. And consequently, the legislature passed a bill several years ago that would allow a municipality to exempt those interests, because collection on some of them is very difficult. So in some cases, it costs more to collect, to go after for collection than it's worth. However, we do include that value in our full value determination, so it's used for school funding. So even if we have, and I don't pick a number, you know, $100,000 or $150 million, whatever it may be, of those properties, we would include them in the full value. So they're going to have to raise the 4 mil equivalency somehow on those. So that answers your question, sir.
Well, you're in an area that is really a little foreign to me, and I apologize for that. I guess there's probably no final answer. I mean, to say, is that a control over whether people are going to, as a borough, would raise property tax, or is it not a control? I mean, if they have to pay taxes themselves, AML is saying that is a good control over how much property tax they charge a mine. If I'm understanding you correctly, I'm not sure that is much of a control.
Well, it is, Mr. Chairman, to some extent. The property that's fee-owned out there by a non-exempt entity is going to pay those taxes. A good example of that, I think, is the city of Valdez. The city of Valdez levies a 20-mil tax. Now, that's a very high tax, but that's the tax rate that the state levies against oil and gas properties. So the city of Valdez basically takes the majority, well, all of the tax dollars for oil and gas within the city boundaries. But the other side of that coin is every person who lives in Valdez pays 20 mils on their property too, so it's a very high mill rate. Is that a control? Of course it is. And those individuals who do pay taxes in those areas, whether, and if there's 500 people in the area, you're not going to have 500 people that are going to be exempt, you know, and let's just split it down the middle 50-50 and say you're going to have 250 of them. Those 250 people are going to pay taxes, and they're going to be very cognizant of what the borough is going to levy on it, you know, whether it's 10 mils or 20 mils or whatever it may be. I mean, that's digging into their back pocket. So if they're wanting to levy a property tax, those who are going to pay are going to pay the same thing. So they can't get around that. Does that help address that?
Yes, it does. It does help a lot. Thank you very much. Any other questions anybody has? I guess one of the areas we're looking at is funding of education. And in this bill, there's a 4 mil property tax to fund education. When I think of my community, not only do we fund it through millage, we also fund it to the cap in other ways. Have you looked at that? Is that, I mean, who do we talk to about what should a fair millage be in order to fund education like the rest of us do?
Mr. Chairman, the four mil is a required local contribution. I mean, that's the minimum that you have to pay. And, you know, if you're going to be looking at doing your own schools, I don't know of anybody that goes four mils. And there may be somebody out there, but typically when they get into funding their own schools, they're not into four mils. But that's required by local, by state law at this time. Now, the CS also changed that, you know, where now it's four mil if you don't levy a property tax, and then six mil if you go ahead and form a borough. So you've got six mils going into the account to the municipality, and if they levy a property tax, then it's up to them whatever they're going to charge everybody else. So whatever they may be charging, whether it's, you know, six, seven mils, that's locally, that's their choice to do on that. But I don't know of anybody that's funding at four mils.
I appreciate your comments. Appreciate your being here.
Yes, sir.
Anything else you know that you want to share with us?
No, it's nice to come down every once in a while and put some faces with names.
Thanks very much. Good to
Thank
see you.
Thank you.
We have... is Joe here? Oh, there you are. Oh, I'm looking right through you. I knew I saw him out there. Senator Terrio and Joe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sorry to be delayed in getting up. I was interested to hear Mr. Van Sant's comments myself. We've been pleased to work with the state agencies on the CS that's before you. We think it addresses many of the concerns. The issue of the severance tax and whether the severance tax should be reserved to the state as the supreme taxing authority, I agree with. Certainly those minerals are reserved to the state, and that's one of the concerns that there has been, that if you allowed the mine to be the only entity basically that's taxed, then what they do is they use that jointly owned property, which, you know, my 32,000 people own part of, your 32,000 people own part of, and they pay their entire burden off of that jointly owned resource. We'd rather have them tax the enterprise, basically tax the activity that's going on as that jointly owned resource is developed and mined. So with that, you know, Joe is here. I've had a chance to yesterday to go through the CS, but not enough because of the press of business lately. Joe's worked out a lot of details, so he's here to answer some of the technical questions that you might have. We think the CS is a good work product.
Thank you, Senator Terrio. Mr. Maylash, would you lead us through this CS and explain to us how it changes the original bill?
Certainly. Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Joe Baylash, staff to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and Senator Terrio. The approach taken here is somewhat different. We began with some language that was submitted by Mr. Van Zandt from the State Assessor's Office, and jumped back and forth between Title 29 and Title 43 as appropriate. There were some things that should have been in Title 29 that related to municipalities, and that was the place to put them. But this is, after all, a state tax, and so Title 43 was the correct place to put the state tax on the mines in the unorganized borough. The first section is simply a reference that needed to be added. Section 2 describes the way the tax will be affecting mines in the unorganized area, but through that Title 29 piece. Section 3 is the reservation of the severance tax to the state. However, it does grandfather in those severance taxes that are currently in place or that come into being by January 1, 2006. If we were to go back to January 1, 2005, we would need a retroactive effective date, and I just asked the drafter to make it as easy as possible, and so without concerning ourselves with retroactivity or anything like that. Section 4 then goes on to what looked very much like the bill as it was first introduced and brought before this committee. There are some changes, however. The mill rate is still linked to the foundation formula, 4 mills, when a mine is located in an unorganized borough. Or it is the mill rate levied by a newly incorporated or the muni that a mine property gets annexed into, the same levy that's charged against all other property in that municipality. So, for instance, it's hard not to talk about the two particular mines in question here that are closest to development, but the Pogo mine, if it were annexed into the Fairbanks North Star borough, would be assessed the 15 mills, just like every other piece of property in the borough. If the Deltana Charter Commission were to be successful in incorporating a new borough with, say, a 10-mill property tax, that would be the mill rate. It still would be assessed and collected by the state, but it would be payable to that municipality. There is also a provision for, in place of the property tax, the negotiation of a state PILT. And likewise, the newly incorporated government or the annexing government could negotiate a PILT with the mine as well. We still have the language regarding the 15 years after production commencement that exempts the particular things that you could otherwise tax on the mine. And that's an attempt to say that while we can think of certain taxes that municipalities currently impose, we are limited by our own imagination. There might be a mayor or city council or attorney out there somewhere whose imagination surpasses our own. The assessment is now going to be done by the state assessor. We followed much of the language that the state assessor recommended. I've not had a chance to talk with him directly since he's been able to review the CS, so I would have to defer to him as to whether or not we actually captured what he wanted. And there was one thing in particular that was different between what Mr. Van Sant recommended and the way we requested the CS to be drafted, and that's on page 6, line 24. And this has to do with the value level of a facility that would be exempt from the tax. We had originally introduced this at the $10 million level. Mr. Van Sant had recommended it go down to $1 million. My understanding is that the Alaska Miners Association had weighed in for this particular level because of the smaller yet substantial mining operations that exist in some parts of the unorganized borough, the substantial investments they make in those facilities. This provision was intended to sort of shield them. Whether or not 10 million is the right number or perhaps something lower, we did not have an opportunity to discuss that with the Alaska Miners Association, but that is one item I can recall that is certainly a difference between the two drafts. And
before you go on, Joe, could you just make sure I understand what we are talking about, reaching that $10 million level? Is it value of the land or just the value of the facility built on that land? Or
It would be the property and the definition of property. Here in the definition section would be the mill, the storage facilities, that aren't open to the public, those...
So all the physical structure installed by the mine.
That's correct. By way of example, in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the assessor there taxes everything that has been added to the property as soon as you cross the boundary, including the power poles and power lines. You know, they're not taxable on the public side of the line, but as soon as you cross over into Fort Knox's territory, they start assessing that and including that in the full and true value. So
road into the mine and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
The way they tax the road at Fort Knox is when you drive to Fort Knox, there's a public road. Everybody can drive on it. You arrive at a gate, and you have to park or get cleared through the gate, and then the road continues on into the mine. Everything past the gate in terms of roads is taxable, but the part that leads up to that gate is not, as I understand it.
Thank you. I'm sorry to stop you. Go ahead.
That's fine. I am done.
Thank you. Any questions of Joe? What?
I might add I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, the mechanism used to negotiate a PILT agreement with the state, the commissioner is directed to follow 4382, that's the Stranded Gas Act, the procedures involved there, the findings, setting out the terms, and then submitting it to the legislature for approval. This is in no way contracting away the state's right to levy a tax, change a tax, remove a tax. The legislature will still have the full ability to go in and modify the terms of that PILT at any point in time.
Have you, that was a question that came up earlier about the issue in the Constitution about not contracting away the right to tax. Have you got a legal opinion on whether PILT is in that or out of that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have specific language here regarding the state PILT to address that question. As regards the municipal PILT, I did not get anything in writing, but this question did come up with the bill drafter, Ms. Kurtz. She posited the question to me, and I suggested to her that the municipality's authority to put in place this PILT sort of implied as it exists today. With this passage of this legislation, there would then be a mechanism authorizing the municipalities to go through a process to do the same thing, but then would be binding. However, that contract wouldn't be absolute in its binding effect. The municipality could appeal to the legislature for relief because it is a creation of statute. And she seemed to think that was a plausible remedy. I didn't ask her for an opinion beyond that.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Any further comments? Sir Terrio, anything that we have not covered here that we should?
We had some discussion last time about the property that is subject to taxation, and I think I pointed out that time that originally the language had been suggested to me that it was all property that was that would be excluded from taxation, limited public access, and I said no. Clearly, you know, if there's limited access to the general public, it should be taxable. If you're sharing facilities with the mine next door, that's an agreement between the two companies. You work that out amongst yourselves. Don't expect that airstrip or that section of the road to be tax exempt. If the general public doesn't have access, full access, then it has to pay the full tax. So that's the way this has been drafted. And then as far as figuring out what gets to the $10 million for the exemption of the smaller operators, it would be that same determination. If something the public had free and unfettered access to something, it would not be taxed. But if the company controls it, it's part of their operation, then it's part of the calculation to see whether you get to that $10 million threshold. We're treating large mines and small minds the same way as far as valuation of the property itself.
Well, as for when a tax is levied, could you comment on that a little bit? Now, is that that's when production begins? Is that in here? Can you direct us to that point and explain what that means? What is production? Is it when you ship the gold bars out, or when you sell them, or what? I don't know.
Let me make sure I find this. Okay, on page 3, line 23 is the section on assessment. That full and true value as of January 1 of the assessment year, the first assessment date shall be the production commencement date. And the production commencement date, I thought we had a definition in here. Yes, in the definition section on page 6, line 29. Means the date on which the initial shipment of products from mining operations is made. So, for instance, thinking about the Red Dog mine, they store the concentrate throughout the year, throughout the winter, until they can load it onto the barges. That's when the shipment gets made. So, you know, for some reason we had I can't imagine a similar situation, but you never know. When those shipments begin is when, that's the year that the tax begins. So that there won't be a tax levied during construction. Particularly when you're talking about these very large, very remote locations, they're going to be having to stage the construction through numerous building seasons and ultimately years. And rather than taxing that activity which is leading to the production and challenging the economics that much further, we wanted to wait until production actually begins.
Thank you. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, and there might be some concern that, you know, like the Red Dog or even Greens Creek, where they warehouse the minerals until a transport can come in and get them, that, well, the company will just delay that. But with this huge upfront investment, as Joe indicated, you know, there's a lot of cost to get the operations up and running, and then the companies have the pressure to get those minerals to the market because they've got a huge debt now to start servicing. So I think that keeps that in balance, that we won't have any games being played there as far as when the tax actually gets turned on.
Yes, please, Senator.
In addition to that, I think we were told last week when we had that presentation, plan on flying the gold out. So if they're planning on flying the gold out, they aren't going to let a lot accumulate before they do start flying it out, I don't think, in this case.
Makes sense. Okay, thank you. Further questions? Anything in wrap-up care to say?
I think tying it to the terms of the Stranded Gas Act is primarily just to tap into that system of best interest finding, how the PILT is negotiated, approval by the legislature. You know, we just didn't want to duplicate that section of the statute, so that's why that reference is made, just to use that structure, basically.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Mr. Van Sant, any response or any questions you may have at this point?
If I could, Mr. Chairman,
please.
I just have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Which we're going to have to administer this. I want to make sure we're going to policymakers.
Might as well find out right now. Huh? Go ahead.
On page 6, 43, 67, 160, exemptions, line 20, that's been...
Say that again, page 6.
I'm sorry, page 6, line 20.
Right.
This on the CS. That one has changed a little bit, and I just want to make sure. This reads that property is used in production or transportation of minerals and it's located in a municipality is exempt. And that wasn't worded like that before. And I'm not sure what the intent there is. That, to me, says if it's in a borough, it's going to be exempt. And I'm not sure that that was the intent, Joe. And if that's... And if this is a working document, we can work on it since it's the first time we got to sit down face-to-face with Joe and see if we can hammer some of these out. But I'm not sure that that's what the intent was.
Mr. Chairman, I would need to go back and look at my notes to figure out whether that was a difference that was a creation of drafting or translating, you know, faxes of faxes or just
sure.
Let that.
Good question. Thank you very much.
Okay, and just one other point of my mind, just so I have it straight, under line 18 of the same page, roads, storage facilities, terminals, docks, airstrips, blah, 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 open to public. Now, this is, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch what the Senator said a while ago, all of it, but that's unlimited use by the public?
Correct.
Okay, so as long as I understand that, then I know what I put on the roll.
Does the phrase use unlimited?
Chairman, the original draft that was provided to us when we were approached for a sponsorship had the word limited public use in there. Senator Terrio was not comfortable with that phrase. He wanted to be open to public use so that it was clear it was available to the public.
Right. Thank you, John.
And that's the same way, well, never mind. Obviously, it's closer. Okay. I think that's it, sir.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate your input there. All right, well, thanks, everyone, very much. Anyone else care to speak to this at this time? Okay, very well. We will share this with our colleagues and make sure everyone has this information and intend to hold a hearing as soon as we can on this.